The little bit of technical difficulties have been now narrowed to apparently the only problem that we're going to have this afternoon is that if they were in, Justice Hardesty and I talk, we won't necessarily be able to see our faces on the webcast. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Both Justice Hardesty and I have agreed that that's probably not an issue at all, but we want you to know what the technical difficulties were. Everything else is functioning as it should. And we are ready to proceed then in the matter of Holmes versus State. We have Mr. Cornell and Mr. Cornell, Richard and Ben. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, and my notes indicate to me that you are going to split your time between the two of you. Is that correct?
Yes, Justice Salen is correct. As what happened last summer with the Sanchez-Dominguez case, this was actually the second case that Ben and I worked on. Right about the time he got admitted to practice, so he will handle the opening remarks, and with the court's permission, I'll handle the rebuttal. And also, I'd like to take the opportunity. Last year, Ben was my mentee under the TIP program. This year, my mentee is August Hotchkin, who came to watch this argument.
And welcome to the TIP program. We're very proud of that. In the next hands. Our record should also reflect that the Chief Justice is with us. She's with us, however, in the Las Vegas courtroom. And with that, if the parties are ready to proceed, we'll call this matter into the record. Holmes versus State, case number 58947. Mr. Cornell.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good afternoon to the justices. May it please the court and counsel. We are well aware of this court's recent order directing us to specifically be prepared for a discussion regarding the admission of rap lyrics against Mr. Holmes, and we fully intend to address that issue thoroughly. However, at the same time, we do not wish for our remaining issues on appeal to appear to be swept to the wayside or look to be a secondary in their significance to this case. We have asserted, we've been able to assert that this case is one where a prodigious amount of trial, or a prodigious amount of cumulative error occurred. And as such, with the court's approval, I would like to begin by briefly addressing our other issues raised on appeal before I delve into the issue concerning rap lyrics. I will go in order of the issue, in order of how the issues appear in the briefs. First, I'd like to speak about the out-of-court statement that was admitted against Mr. Holmes, and that was a statement from his co-defendant, Max Reed. We raised this issue as the first in our briefs because we feel that it is the most clear and egregious instance of trial error that was present in this case. It is unquestionable that the statement of Max Reed, which both implicated Holmes in the robbery and occurred well after completion of the crime, should not have come into evidence under NRS 51035-3E and the Sixth Amendment's Confrontation Clause. And in its answering brief, the state seems to concede that point through silence. The state is completely silent on our arguments as to the substance of the issue, and instead raises an argument that the defense counsel should have made a contemporaneous objection to that evidence as it came in. Addressing the state's argument, I will point out that the court below did grant a pretrial motion in limine on that exact issue regarding hearsay statements of unavailable witnesses, whereby defense counsel put the court on notice that it would be objecting to those types of statements. And furthermore, the Confrontation Clause issues may be raised to this court on plain error anyhow. Additionally, defense counsel did object in the courtroom to that evidence, perhaps not contemporaneously in the purest sense of the word, but on the transcript, I believe it's on the very next page where the objection comes in, and the court did rule on that objection. So those are our responses to the argument that the contemporaneous objection should have been made, but again, we will note that it appears to be the case that the state has conceded that this was error.
Mr. Cornell, am I right that there was a bench conference shortly after the objection, and there's no transcript in the record of the bench conference?
No, there was a transcript that I believe was added as supplementally along with the reply brief.
At the end of finished. Could you give the clerk the record site for that, please?
I could.
Not now. Don't use your time doing that. But
absolutely.
Please, thank you.
Because time is a scarce resource here, I'll move on to the second issue, which is our Siebert issue. This one we think might be of interest to the court because, in our opinion, this case might be one of the ones that's come along with the best factual setup since Siebert for an application of the law announced in Siebert. And once again, in its answering brief, the state has not discussed our reliance on Siebert with respect to this particular issue. The state instead makes the argument only that Holmes was not in custody for purposes of Miranda determinations. I will address the state's argument, but first, to reiterate our position on Siebert here, we simply do not see how this can be a case, or how this cannot be an instance of law enforcement intentionally eliciting an unworn confession and then using that confession to elicit a second worn confession in light of the fact that the officers, when they interviewed Mr. Holmes, had an arrest warrant in their hand. A substantial amount of investigation had already occurred at that point. The Reno homicide detectives had probable cause to arrest Mr. Holmes. They had his DNA on the cigarette butt. They had already interviewed four material witnesses, one being the victim, Kenny Clark, and additionally Tanisha Williams, Jafar Richardson, and the neighbor eyewitness, Jennifer Wendell. So the detectives had done their homework there, and throughout, or in its response to this issue, the state has taken the position that perhaps the detectives were merely looking for a story that, perhaps could have given an innocuous reason for that incriminating cigarette to have been there, or to delve a little further into Mr. Holmes' history with Reno. But, frankly, we cannot think of a story that Mr. Holmes could have possibly given to the homicide detectives that would have caused them to, throw out the arrest warrant and set him free on his way. Addressing the argument that Holmes was not in custody, the state has relied primarily on two United States Supreme Court cases. That would be Minnesota versus Murphy and Stansbury versus California. And I think that in our briefs we've sufficiently differentiated the facts of this case from those two cases. Minnesota versus Murphy provides that under the circumstances of that case, the probation officer's office was held not to be a custodial environment. But it was different circumstances there. There, the defendant was making a voluntary appearance, well, perhaps not completely voluntary, but he drove himself to his PO's office for a routine appointment with his parole officer, and he made inculpatory statements to his parole officer while being in an office that he had been in several times before. Here, it's different. Mr. Holmes was transported. He had no say on whether or not he had to appear at his parole officer's office. He was transported there to meet with two homicide detectives, not POs, in a room that he had never been in before, and I think that differentiates our case from that case. Stansbury versus California, on the other hand, provides that the custodial setting or the degree of restraint is to be evaluated by courts in terms of what was known objectively to the suspect and not was subjectively intended by the police officers. However, we would submit that under Allward versus State, this court doesn't quite see things in those same sorts of shades of black and white. Allward provides that an important consideration, Allward provides first and foremost that custody determinations are made under a totality of the circumstances test, and that an important part of that totality of the circumstances test is whether or not the investigation had already focused on the subject, and I think here it is unquestionable that it had. Again, since I can see the time is ticking, I think it would be best that I jump into the rap lyrics issue right now. I think the best way to concisely state this issue before the court is to ask whether or not it was error for the court below, whether or not it was error for the court below to essentially treat the rap lyrics written by Mr. Holmes as if they had been an entry in a diary or a personal journal. That is a piece of writing that is both literal and self-referential, or, to put it one other way, as an admission. Granted, under certain circumstances, rap lyrics no doubt may be considered admissions. However, a fair and proper consideration of the admissibility of the lyrics is what must first be performed. And that's what we're here to talk about today, whether or not a fair and proper consideration of these lyrics was performed. To recap our stance as expressed in the briefs, rap music is both a highly particularized genre and it is also a statement of culture. And because of this, there is a necessary contextual filter through which you have to view any piece of writing genuinely intended to be rap lyrics. As a consequence, it is often going to be the case that words written as rap lyrics do not have the same probative value that an ordinary statement with the same sort of content would. And just as it is with any other piece of evidence, a diminished tendency to prove something as true causes the evidence to become less relevant. Now, this, of course, this all plays into an analysis under 48035. And we provided for, in the briefs, exactly how relevance is affected by the contextual factors that underlie rap music. When one compares rap lyrics to ordinary speech, there is a tremendous potential for disparate meaning. Rap music is entertainment, and it's also art. There are themes of braggadocio, there are themes of exaggerated masculinity and laying claim to bad acts, often criminal activity, sometimes true, sometimes false. Well, all of these things are a staple in rap music. And therefore, there is a potential for untruthfulness that, to a degree, we submit is inherent to the genre. It is this inherent potential that sufficiently differentiates rap music from actual confessions which simply might not be true, which is how the state feels that that's the sort of framework that, that we should look at these types of issues through.
Mr. Cornell, I might tend to agree with you with respect to considering rap lyrics in the context in which we've come to understand that they sometimes are exaggerated. But what about a situation like this, where it seems to be so specific to the crime as it appeared to have unwrapped in front of
Well, in a situation like this, and I will note that the court below admitted these lyrics for their relevance, particularly as to identity, our position is that the court should use the test for admissibility that it would use for evidence that goes to identity. And that is a much more stringent test than that of 48035, simply weighing the probative value against the risk of prejudice. Of course, risk of prejudice is it's going to be an issue in these types of circumstances with rap lyrics because, you know, there's violent and offensive content often runs prevalent in rap lyrics. But our argument is that the lyrics should be admissible only, just like any other evidence going to identity would be, if they function as a signature so clear as to establish the identity of the defendant. And we've established in the briefs that, although there, of course there were similarities in the rap lyrics here and the crimes as charged, but at the same time the rap lyrics also talked about assaulting a man in a nightclub, stealing a piece of jewelry off that man, and pimping women in parking lots. And all of those aspects of the lyrics, you know, whether or not they're true, they're uncharged acts of misconduct, and therefore added to the prejudice of this piece of evidence. I'm going to save the remaining time for rebuttal if the justices have no further questions.
Just one. What if the sentence had said, "I catch him slipping at the club and Jack Nelson for his necklace"? Would that have been admissible?
And Jack Nelson?
And Jack Nelson for his necklace.
As in, he stole a necklace from a man named Nelson?
Well, I'm just offering the words. It seems to me that I'm curious to know how you would evaluate and how a district judge should evaluate those rap lyrics.
Well, I think it depends on what exactly the defendant in that hypothetical case has been charged with. If it was...
He's charged with here.
The same charges as here. Well, I would argue that would be inadmissible. I mean, once again, I mean, it's referring to a specific person, but once again, it's still acts of uncharged misconduct, highly prejudicial, and not relevant to the crimes as charged here.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. McCarthy. I'm going to give you an extra 2 minutes because I'm going to add an extra 2 minutes onto the appellant side when rebuttal is taken. And I think I'd like to start with what appears to be an acknowledged error. I think I know that we were not the trial attorney in this case, but I think that we acknowledge that in fact some of the statements made by the prosecutor in this case may have been inappropriate. Fair statement?
No.
Close.
I acknowledge my responses. The defense closing argument in this case, I assume we're talking about the prosecutor's closing argument. The defense closing argument reads like a textbook of misconduct, attributing personal motives to the prosecutor and things like that. This prosecutor merely responded that, and the late 80s, I think, that this court published what I call the Yates footnote, saying, telling the district courts, why don't you put a stop to this? And it still hasn't happened. In my experience, one time recently, that this court approved a district court declaring a mistrial because of defense misconduct. The prosecutor has to respond to that kind of thing. When the defense attorney stands up and says, ladies and gentlemen, you should acquit because he's a big fat liar. That prosecutor is hiding evidence from you. That prosecutor has this personal belief. If there is no response by the district court, then the prosecutor has to respond in order to avoid miscarriage of justice.
Or you could object.
You can't object, but that is probably the preferred method. This judge has said throughout the argument, through every objection, this is closing argument, rely on your own memory. There's no reason to believe that Judge Blair or any other district court judge of the state is going to shut it down to give the proper response to the jury. Saying, disregard that. It's untrue. And the prosecutor could jump up and say, I wish to be sworn. I wish to tell my side of the story. You can talk about my beliefs. I want the jury to hear my beliefs. Of course, the judge is not going to allow that either. This is probably not the best response that a prosecutor could have to this kind of misconduct, but he has to have some sort of response. And I suggest it was an invited response. And because it's invited, this court shouldn't find error. There has to be something. You have to be able to do something in response to that sort of misconduct. In answer to your question, no, I don't concede it was inappropriate. It ordinarily would be, I think. But not in this case. Okay, so moving right along here. Justice Hersey, there is no such transcript. You asked about a transcript of the bench conference. It does not exist. The linked transcript that Mr. Cornell mentioned, that's from a motion to suppress hearing. So there was a supplemental appendix about another hearing. The truth in that is somebody objected to something on some grounds. I don't know who objected to what or what the ruling was. So I suggest that is no objection at all. The district court judge responded that there would be a limiting instruction to something, but we don't know what it was. I suggest that the hearsay statement at issue could have been admissible for limited purposes. The statement was something along the lines of, Colleen just started shooting. Colleen was the nickname of Mr. Holmes, the defendant in this case. And so it could have been used as some sort of identifier. So the hearsay could have been admitted to show simply Holmes was known as Colleen. That is the name. So it could also have been shown to show that, admitted to show that the declarant, Max Reed, was present, that he had some knowledge of the events. Now, whether that's why it was offered, or whether that was the nature of the objection or the nature of the ruling, I don't know. If this were a de novo review, then maybe it would come out different. But it isn't. We review specific rulings of the district court judge, and in this case, we have no ruling to review. There are ways in which it could have been admitted, and there's no indication that the judge went some other way. So we ought to just skip that, because there's no reviewable ruling. On the motion to suppress, I would first point out, there's no confession here. There's a discussion of trying to get an unwarned confession and then a subsequent warned confession. This defendant never confessed. His statements that he sought to suppress were, I wasn't there, I don't know these people, I don't know anything about it. So I first suggest that doesn't sound terribly prejudicial, since his defense was, I wasn't there, I don't know these people, and I don't know anything about it. But more importantly, that if the original statement need not be preceded by the Miranda warnings, and there's no misconduct that allows an inquiry then into the second statement. So I'm being awkward here. If the statement didn't require the Miranda warnings because it was not custodial, that should be the end of the hunt. We have a ruling by the district court. There are facts supporting that ruling. The district court said this was not custodial. There are some facts asserted in the brief that are supported by very little. For instance, the contention that this defendant had never been in that room before. My recollection is the probation officer said, I don't know if that's true or not. The probation officer testified that his probationer came to the station voluntarily, not the station, there was no station, came to the probation officer's office voluntarily. He was not in handcuffs at any time. He was left alone in the waiting room, the public waiting room of this office for some period, don't know how long. When the local counsel arrived, Detective Jenkins told him whether or not he had anything to say was completely up to him. In short, I guess, the question is whether you have a degree of restraint associated with formal arrest. When there's no restraint, it can't be that degree associated with formal arrest. He had a conversation with some cops. He didn't have to, but he did. And there's nothing wrong with admitting then his denial. But was it Arizona versus Fulminante of 1991 said that even an involuntary confession can be harmless error. This is supposedly a denial. So I don't see how it could be harmful to have this evidence that he denied the crime. But I suggest primarily that there's no error at all because there was no custodial interrogation. There's certainly interrogation, but not the circumstances that require the warning. Let's see, now there was lyrics. Whether these lyrics are autobiographical or fictional is ultimately for the jury to decide. It is possible in every case that a confession, a statement of culpability, is false. Here's one I dealt with recently. A fellow confessed to his cellmates in the jail, and later on in post-conviction, his claim was, I never confessed to them. I was merely describing what that idiot prosecutor was trying to prove. Whether that is true or not should be up to the jury. So we shouldn't have the judge making these determinations. If the Constitution demands the exclusion because the lyrics were involuntary, there's no evidence rule that says because all evidence could be false, all evidence must be excluded. There's no evidence rule like that. So, and I was being somewhat facetious in my table of contents in the brief when I said that the Constitution doesn't demand the exclusion of a confession that rhymes. That's the only thing different between this confession and any other confession. Now, it's possible. I mean, he can claim that it was not autobiographical, that it was fiction. But that's additional evidence that could be presented to the jury. That's not something for this court to decide. There's a discussion here this court, not this jury, but this court must view this genre with certain filters. That you must determine that because some people use this genre as fiction, that no jury can hear anything if it rhymes, if it's rhythmic. Well, I got to admit, I'm not familiar with that rule of law. I suggest it would be unwise. If the defendant wished to present other evidence, if he would wish to present either his own testimony, saying this is not autobiographical, this was just fiction, I was bragging, or if he wished even to present some expert in the field, someone knowledgeable of the culture who could come in and say, this language jacking someone in the parking lot is a customary phrase that has a meaning other than jacking someone in the parking lot. I suppose that could happen. You could present that kind of evidence in an effort to persuade the jury to believe that this song was not autobiographical. But there was no such evidence, and it's not for this court to do it as a matter of law. It's up for the jury to decide, based on the evidence, whether this particular song is a confession or fiction. The fact that there are some great similarities between the song and the facts of the crime support the conclusion that it was autobiographical. But that, again, is for the jury, not for this court. I knew I'd run time. Your offer of 2 minutes was fine, and I don't think I need it if the court has no additional questions. All right, we're done.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. Mr. Cornell.
Thank you. If it pleases the court, regarding the question on harmlessness, I doubt that was where we were going as opposed to prosecutorial misconduct. The prosecutorial misconduct issues are well stated in the brief. But as far as the trial errors, the out-of-court statement of Max Reed, the rap lyrics, the statement about I've never been to Reno, the unborn statement, and so forth, the problem is, typically for harmless position purposes, we look at the record and say, how strong is the case? This was a circumstantial evidence case without actual confession by the defendant. As circumstantial evidence cases go on the cold record, it was a pretty strong case, I think. The problem is, the prosecutor accentuated all of those pieces of evidence that we assert are error in the closing argument. And per Roland versus State, I think that puts us into a different era of harmlessness versus prejudicial. And why would that be so? Because maybe on the cold record, these witnesses that the state called, Tanisha Williams and Ford and Richardson and so forth, look pretty good, but on the hot record, maybe they didn't look so good. And maybe that's why, in the circumstantial evidence case, the trial prosecutor stressed the rap lyrics, stressed the out-of-court statement of Reed, and so forth. When you look at it that way, the error suddenly was not quite so harmless. Now, with respect to the rap lyrics issue, really, I would suggest to this honorable court that the best way to look at it is how the North Carolina Supreme Court looked at it in the Cheeseboro case, and I would urge this court to adopt the rationale of Cheeseboro. The problem is, it all comes through a cultural filter. So is the author of the rap lyrics actually making an admission, or is he making a piece of art of somebody bragging about something that he did that would sell to people who enjoy rap music? That's the first issue. The second issue is, if he's writing about himself, is he writing about what he actually did, or is he reciting what the police reports say? We don't really know, which is why, really, you have to look at this not as uncharged misconduct or wrongs so much under 48045, but acts. The act of writing a lyric that sounds sociopathic is an act. It comes under 48045, and if it's going to be an admission, it should come pursuant to the cultural filter under the identity exception, which frankly has the highest test for probative value. These lyrics are inherently prejudicial. I don't think I need to say any more. The question is, are they probative? And if they really don't show a signature, if there are differences, then it really isn't probative. You know, to answer Justice Hardesty's interesting hypothetical, knowing that hypotheticals are traps for the unwary, have these rap lyrics said, I jacked Nelson in the parking lot, that would be a closer case because Nelson is the name of the victim. Even so, with all this other stuff about pimping and so forth, it's talking about something other than what our client certainly did in the charge conduct, maybe talking about something other than what he's ever done in his life. And it's still looking through the cultural filter that we have with rap lyrics. It's still a far cry from the laying the rose on the tombstone or that kind of thing that we learn in law school about the identity exception. So With respect to the statement, remember, the police are done with their investigation. They have the arrest warrant in hand. They're ready to arrest him. And again, as my son said, what possible story could Holmes have told them if he's being warned that would have caused them, like in It's a Wonderful Life, to tear up the warrant? There is no story. There is none. They had plenty of evidence for probable cause. Why did they do what they did? The only answer that I can see is they wanted to get a story out of him, and they got a story which was paper or false. I've never been to Reno, Nevada in my life. Oh, really? How come we have your DNA on a cigarette butt that was found in Reno, Nevada? Oh, well, I was there, but only on hot August nights in 2002. Really? Well, we found the cigarette butt in November of 2003. They even go so far as to trick him into, you know, what brand of cigarettes do you smoke? We'll go get you some. And, of course, it's the same kind of brand of the cigarette butt that they find. What does that do? It means we're going to arrest you. If you have a trial and you testify, we've got immediate impeachment evidence in front of you, unless you're going to come in with that story, which is false. So that's why you have to look at this case not merely from Minnesota versus Murphy, but really from Siebert. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Cornell. Thank you, Mr. McCarthy. This matter will stand submitted. We will be at ease while the next case and its lower attorneys assembly at the desk.